This is Engineering Journey.
Hi, welcome to Season 2, Episode 11 of Engineering Heroes, a podcast that presents the incredible engineers that are shaping our society and battling our challenging issues. My name is Mel, and my co-host and our podcast's resident engineer speaking to us from the trenches is Dom.
Do you ever think, do I really have the experience to be doing this? Are these the right answers? Should I be working on a project as important as this? Imposter syndrome is alive and well in the engineering industry. Engineers that are honestly great at their job sometimes feel like they don't know enough or might even be unsure with the level of responsibility that comes with the job. Our guest today speaks to us about her experiences with imposter syndrome. She's an incredible engineer, having graduated from the University of Adelaide with a Bachelor of Engineering in Electrical and Electronics Engineering, and she also received a degree in Maths and Computer Science. She worked with Alstom on Sydney's new light rail network as a design engineer, design coordinator, and systems engineer. However, most recently, she's a project engineer for the Opal reactor at ANSTO Lucas Heights. In addition to this, she's been doing an exceptional job holding positions at Young Engineers Australia Sydney. First, she was the communications manager. However, now she holds the position of secretary. Our guest is no stranger to organising events such as the Young Engineers Australia Drinks in February of this year, where we initially met her. But Mel also worked very closely with tonight's guest when Young Engineers Australia Sydney hosted Beer with an Engineer's first birthday party in 2019. Tonight we'd like to welcome Lucy Griffith.
Lucy loved maths, doing all the maths she could in high school. She was also really good at physics and chemistry.
So when I was trying to figure out what kind of university study, what kind of career I wanted to go into, I just knew that it had to be something where I could use that knowledge. And in an applied way. And of course, the natural progression from that is engineering. So I decided to go into electrical and electronic engineering because on the open day at the university, there was this wonderful one of the lecturers that was presenting to all of the prospective first years. And she was a woman, and I went, oh, great, so electrical engineering, they've got chicks.
They're already got people. Right
in. Yeah. And then, of course, when I turned up for my first day, I found out that it's got one of the least number of females. But I still enjoyed it. That was how I got into it.
And so what was the first project that you worked on when you finished your degree?
So after university, I started on my graduate program, which was actually at ANSTO, which is where I work now.
Oh, right.
Oh, okay. So you went straight to ANSTO.
Went straight to ANSTO, moved up to Sydney, and I was actually working as a cyclotron engineer at the cyclotron in Camperdown. So we were operating and maintaining. So really, I didn't have a lot of project work in the first couple of years, but I was I guess my project for myself was learning how the system worked and how to troubleshoot it and how to operate and maintain it.
And so what sort of things were you doing?
So I would shadow the cyclotron engineer that worked there full time. He was actually didn't get the title of cyclotron engineer because he did a physics degree.
No.
Made that mistake. So I shadowed him for those first few years, and we maintained the cyclotron, which is a type of particle accelerator, and we operated it as well for the research facility that it was in.
Is that like a little CERN?
It's a little bit like a little CERN. So a cyclotron accelerates particles in a spiral pattern. So it's much more compact than the CERNs or the synchrotron type accelerators. It was just in a little 6x6 meter vault.
Well, so not as exciting as CERN overseas, but still, I had no idea we had something like that in Australia.
Yes, well, we have a number of them. We have them in most hospitals, actually, because they produce some of the radioisotopes that are used for medical purposes.
Oh, there you go. And are they all managed by engineers like yourself?
Yes. So it's usually engineers that maintain them. I think operators don't necessarily have to have an engineering degree, but definitely the maintainers do.
Okay. And whereabouts are you working now?
So what happened in between, I went and worked for Alstom on the wonderful light rail project in the Sydney CBD.
Oh, you worked on that one.
I did. So that was a big change from ANSTO, because I went from the government sector to the private sector. Mm. And it was on a big infrastructure project. So it was very high stress. It was everything had to be done yesterday, but lots of opportunity for learning, and learn I did, but it became a bit too fast paced for me and I wanted a bit of a change, and there was a opportunity then back at ANSTO. So I went for that, and that's how I ended up back there as a project engineer.
So what was the gap?
It was about 18 months that I was on the big infrastructure project.
Do you do one of those sort of things like, I built that, or like that's my bit of the track there?
I do a little bit of that. People often aren't that impressed.
I didn't say it was an impressive.
You need to have other engineers, yeah. Then they'd be impressed, because yeah. Then they understand yes. Just exactly what was involved. But
that's right. And I think once it's running, it'll be a bit more of a impressive thing to say I had a hand in that.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. At the moment, it's more of a hassle.
Yeah, well, it's not long now. At least they're running tests up and down through George Street, so.
That's right.
Not long at all.
No. And so you went back to ANSTO. And so what sort of things are you doing now as the project engineer?
So, yes, as a project engineer in the reactor engineering team, we have two different types of engineer there, if you can split it down that way. So we have the project engineers like me, and then we have the system engineers. The system engineers have ownership over one or multiple of the auxiliary systems that keep the reactor running safely and well. And so they spend their business as usual time on planning of maintenance and dealing with any breakdowns or anything that comes up day to day. And they're quite busy with that. And being a nuclear facility, we are very highly regulated. Yeah. So any changes that need to happen to the facility, to any of the plant, goes through a very rigorous change control process, which means something that may be considered a relatively small change in another industrial plant is a big job for us in terms of the documentation that we have to produce.
And so is that what you would do? Or
that's right. That's where I come in. So I spend my time building up the documentation for the change control submissions. And basically, if we have anything that needs to be upgraded or replaced, a lot of our components, you can't get the same one anymore. Mm-hmm. So everything has to be assessed. And if it's not assessed as a like-for-like change, then it gets escalated and it's a big change control.
Do you get frustrated with the preconceived ideas of what the reactor's doing as well? Because I'm pretty sure out there in the general population, no one really knows what that reactor's about. It's just so frustrating when you talk to people about it as well. They think we've got a mini Chernobyl sitting in the middle of a...
I was thinking The Simpsons, honestly, the nuclear power plant up from The Simpsons, and you just see that always melting down or... things like that.
That's right. It is a bit of a frustration. So for a long time, the nuclear industry in Australia was very hush-hush, and we don't want PR because, we don't want people coming to visit. But now we want them to know what we do, and we want them to know where we are. So I get one of two reactions when I tell people that I work at ANSTO. The majority of the people go, oh, what's that? Oh, I didn't realise we had a nuclear reactor. And other people go, oh my goodness, do you glow in the dark? But of course, yeah, so the reactor that I work at is a research reactor, which means it's many, many times smaller than a power reactor. So we use it to produce neutrons, basically. It's like a neutron factory. And then we use those neutrons to do scientific research. We can use them for imaging, similarly to the way that you can use electrons and x-rays for imaging, but you get different images. And we also use them to produce nuclear medicine. We produce most of Australia's nuclear medicine down at the reactor. Our biggest product is technetium 99, which is used as a diagnostic mainly. So mm-hmm. that's a radioisotope that's used in diagnostics.
So lots to of identify different... to identify if you've got cancer or anything.
Is that... Yeah, used for a lot of different cancer scans and bone scans and brain scans and things.
All right. And is the Australian little plant that you're working at, is that able to keep up with the demand, or is it kind of bursting at the seams?
Well, yes, we actually export overseas as well.
Oh, okay.
All right.
So in the last few years, we've had worldwide, there's been another reactor that did produce a lot of this radioisotope, which has shut down, reached end of life and they couldn't operate it anymore. So we moved to fill that gap. We built a big new facility so that we could process higher volumes of material to get it to get more of this technetium out.
Okay, that's very interesting.
Yes, yeah. I'm glad you said that. I've spent a lot of time at ANSTO in various guises, even years and years ago with materials testing. So it's really not all about the reactor as well. It's there's so much that goes on there. It's very much a science hub.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Yes, yeah, so much more there than just the reactor. It's the heart of the place, but there's much more to it.
Okay, I'm just going to pause it there for a moment. Lucy has shared a lot with us so far about working at Australia's only nuclear plant. And when we come back, we will be deep diving into what it means when an engineer experiences imposter syndrome. But first, Lucy wanted to share some information about an exciting conference that's taking place in 2020.
If you're interested in nuclear engineering or nuclear medicine or anything to do with the nuclear field, you should come along. IYNC2020.org next March.
So IYNC is the International Youth Nuclear Conference. Bit of a big deal in the whole nuclear space industry. So if you're interested, check it out in our show notes. The link's there, www.engineeringheroes.com.au. And if you want to go straight to Lucy's page, it's /S2E11. Now, Lucy is such an amazing guest. She's going to talk about an incredibly personal topic, one that she's not alone in experiencing. She's going to talk about her experience with imposter syndrome.
It's a psychological phenomenon where a person can't or has trouble internalizing their successes. So for me, that looks like a lot of procrastination, a lot of feeling like I don't know enough to be in the position I'm in, and a lot of feeling like everyone around me knows far more than I do. Which is not always true. It's funny, actually, I was a little bit nervous about doing the interview today, and I was thinking to myself, oh, am I qualified enough to talk on this topic?
Oh my God.
And then I realised how ironic that was.
The act of questioning yourself is making you the most qualified person possible. And is that something that, now I'm going to say, it's not just focused on engineers who have this experience.
Yeah, it's quite common.
Is there something that's from an engineering perspective that it can cause issues?
Yes, there is. I feel when you transition from university to the workplace in engineering, you go from learning all of this technical background and you go into the workplace and there's all this extra stuff that you need to learn.
Yes.
And that can kind of lead to a bit of feeling like, well, you know, I've been at university for 4 years. Shouldn't I be prepared for everything? Yeah. But that's not the case. You've got to learn when you start any new role. There's a lot to learn always. Yeah, so I feel like in engineering particularly, there's always a lot to learn when you enter a new role.
Yeah, I always saw with engineering, it's almost as though going to uni is a bit like doing a trade where you're an apprentice for 4 years and then you come out and you still, even if you do a trade, you're a journeyman. You do 2 years of being a journeyman before you get your ticket. And it's a bit like that, I suppose, in anything. It really,
yeah.
you learn certain things, but you don't learn the things that you need to apply until you're actually doing them. You're involved in them. They're your day-to-day tasks. And that's the only way that you're really going to learn on the job. And I agree with you completely because it is really hard, particularly when you first come out and you think you're meant to know more than you are. And even then, when you progress through your career and you get to, you kind of, you work your way up through, you know, graduate engineer, design engineers to project management roles or business development roles, and you're still sort of sitting there thinking to yourself, do I know the same amount as everyone who's sitting around this table? Is this, and it does take a while to sort of let yourself realize that, yeah, actually, I am. I do know this stuff, and I have been practicing it for the last however many years, so that I understand exactly what's going on. I know for myself, I was sitting around a table at one stage thinking to myself, should I really be at this table? And then I realized that I was probably the greyest person there out of all the people I've seen. I probably had 5 years on everyone that I was sitting around the table with. You go, yeah, righto, okay. People always do that whole fake it till you make it, and I hate that because I prefer to know what I need to know, and then if I don't know it, let the people around me know that I'm not stretching myself to try and provide expertise on something that I don't really know about.
Yeah. So that's pretty much hit the nail on the head of what I'm talking about.
Well, it just goes to show that, you know, there's other engineers out there that are experiencing the same thing.
That's right. Yeah, I talked to a number of colleagues about it today. I was telling them about how I was doing this interview, and they all said, oh, yeah, I know that feeling, of course. I guess it's one of those things where in order to deal with it, I have to keep reminding myself that everyone around me, they don't necessarily know exactly what their next step is. And especially as engineers, it's about working out how to do the next thing. And figuring that out and problem solving that. And also the other mechanism to help deal with imposter syndrome is to gather evidence of where the work that I've put in has led to successes. And that's where this role that I'm in currently feels like it's a little bit harder for me. So I've gone from that very fast-paced, huge infrastructure project where we're constantly getting to milestones and meeting.
Achieving.
You're moving, achieving.
Yeah.
That's right. Constantly moving forward and gathering achievements. So it was quite a bit easier for me there to gather my evidence and go, oh, yes, open the box and, oh, yeah, I've got this and this and this from the recent, you know, months and weeks. I'm doing okay. Whereas the role I'm in at the moment, because of the very high level of control around any changes, it means that it moves quite a bit slower. And so my goals are a little more long term, which makes it a little bit harder for me to collect things to put in that box, which is why I'm struggling with it a little bit more in my current role than I was in my last.
Definitely. Did you experience that when you were a graduate?
Funnily enough, it was a bit less when I was a graduate, I think because there was an acknowledgement that I was fresh out of uni.
Right, yep.
And so
you could accept that within yourself that, yeah, no, I don't know everything. I'm not here to do that yet. I'm here to learn. And what is it, 5 years down the track, you're kind of like, well, I should know by now. But
that's right. That's the feeling. So yeah. I could be a little kinder to myself when I was a graduate. And now I find myself being a little harsher on what I should know, what I feel I should know. But it's something that I am just working on all the time.
What sort of things are helping? So you've got your, what did you call it, your box of...
A box of gathered evidence.
A box of evidence, in a way, maybe keeping track on your CV and, you know, so you can sort of say, yep, done this. So you're kind of bolstering yourself there. What other things can be put in place to help this situation, especially since you're not the only one that's experiencing this?
That's right. I think being upfront as much as I can with my team. So I have a habit of I'll try and solve something myself first. It's not always a bad thing because sometimes I can, you know, find the answer. But more and more I'm trying to limit the amount of energy that I spend doing that when I know that a team member will probably have the answer. And I will go to that resource because our teams that we work with are such great resources for us. And really drawing on the knowledge of others in our team is a part of being an effective engineer, I think.
So you're learning that I don't need to know the answer. I need to know who to go to get the answer.
Yeah.
That sort of thing. Yeah. So that again, that comes with experience and learning what people around you can do and what their skills are and things.
And engineering is such a collaborative process as well. Yes. So the more that you – well, the time you spend with other people, which it's kind of – it's counterintuitive as well with engineers because most engineers like to work alone. But the more time you spend with other people, the more you learn, the more they learn, and the more you can develop ideas and create change. It is really good to use that resource. It seems as though once you work out that that's something that's such a benefit, it's almost as though you've unlocked the key to learning so much more.
Mm, yeah, of course.
Do your managers have any role in this?
Yeah, so my direct manager is also a young engineer. He's not much older than myself. He's our team leader. And so I feel quite comfortable going to him when I am struggling a little bit with my imposter syndrome. And he's quite good with affirming that, yes, you know, I am a valuable member of the team.
Yes.
And a good engineer, and I am getting things done. And so that's always good to hear it from another person. So that's definitely a big part of helping me out with that.
Are you finding mentors might help? Do you have a mentor that you
can
approach?
Yes, I do.
Does that help the situation as well?
It does. It helps greatly. I haven't caught up with my mentor as much as I did when I was a graduate. Actually, she's just moved on. So my mentor was working at ANSTO. I got her she was designated my mentor when I was a graduate there. But we kept in contact even when I left and went to Alstom to work for a bit. And yeah, so I don't catch up with her as much as I did when I was a graduate, but that really did help put into perspective early career, I guess, and it being okay that I don't know everything, for sure.
I think it's a really good opportunity to then go and sit with your peers and run through where you're at in your career and what you've done and examples of what you've done. So then that way you can actually have someone else see where you're at. I think that was something that I found really interesting, actually, because it's almost as though it's someone standing on the outside looking in on your career, who isn't involved in your career, who's not even necessarily involved in your special facet of your career either. They're adjacent to it. So then that way it gives you the opportunity to take a step back and justify where you're at. And then once you've achieved it, then it really does show you that you've reached a certain goal as far as your career goes as well.
Yeah, and they have just changed the process, actually, for chartership. As you probably went through the new process, Dom.
Yes.
Yeah. It's no longer 16 full essays that you have to write, so it seems far more achievable now as a process to go through, especially looking at it as a young engineer. But certainly, and it's something that I've been encouraged quite a bit to undertake through working with Young Engineers Australia Sydney. Because, of course, Engineers Australia provide the service of assessing chartership. Yeah, so there's a very strong encouragement to do that from that side. And I think it would be a good objective measure as well.
I think it's one of those things where, you know, you put something out into the future. So if it is a chartered or a certain KPI set by your manager or a challenge that your mentor gives you or, you know, something along those that you need to move towards, and then when you achieve that, you put that into your box and then you go to the next one. I feel like there's some really good points that we've come up here. So what are your thoughts on the future of engineering?
I think the future of engineering is in cross-disciplinary teams. And I think the engineers coming through now, graduating, the young engineers that I'm working with are all going to be having knowledge across different disciplines of engineering in order to be able to work together and to integrate systems and to bring to life the projects that are coming on, because there's so much more integration of different technologies now. And there's just going to be more of that into the future, I think.
Yeah, it's tough because I can remember even when I went through, I was learning CAD-CAM systems using programs that were redundant before I even walked out of the, before I graduated. And it all changes so quickly that, and I agree with you completely, that it is something where you can't just sort of walk out and go, I'm a mechanical engineer, I'm just going to do mechanical engineering, because you need to know electrical engineering, you need to know hydraulic services, and you need to know fire services if you're in the building industry. It is something where you need to be able to evolve to all of those various facets of how it all comes together. And you don't need to specialise in them, but just to understand them makes life so much easier when you're on a massive project.
That's right.
I'm just going to tie it back and probably make myself sound 100 years old. But I'm finding those youngins that are coming out of uni now, stop laughing at me, Dom, they're brash. And they're, you know, I probably was a bit like this myself when I left, but we went through climate strike recently where there are teenagers going in there going, I'm changing the world. I'm going to change the world. I don't know. Do you think they're going to suffer as much from imposter syndrome as what you and Dom have talked about that you've experienced yourselves? Or are they actually going, no, I'm changing the world and get out of my way. I know what I'm doing. That sort of feelings.
If anything, I think the younger generation of engineers are going to experience imposter syndrome even worse than what Dom or I have had to deal with. Thanks to the internet, we are so connected now and everyone can compare themselves to the highest of achievers. And I think that makes it really hard, especially if you're very passionate about creating change, when the systems in the societies that we have are very resistant to change. And you've got the high achievers to compare yourself to, I think it'll be quite difficult for them in that sense.
I think the other scary thing is sometimes the people that we think are high achievers aren't necessarily high achievers. They're just very good at promoting themselves as well. So, which makes it even worse,
right?
Because there doesn't necessarily need to be the substance behind some of the things that they say. And they don't really have time to delve in to see whether or not there's any substance behind it. Because there's so much more information coming in, which makes it even worse. So, yeah, it is very, very hard. What would you say to people that are just starting out in engineering?
I would say it's okay if you don't know everything. And just remember that it's about figuring out how you're going to take the next step. And as engineers, that's what we do. We problem solve, we figure it out. And we work in teams. Yep. So that's what I would say.
It's definitely a career of learning.
Lifelong learners.
Yeah, that's right. It's a bit of a case of need to learn something new every day.
Even though you come out of uni, you've still got so much to go. You're constantly learning and having to move forward. Yeah. You can never rest on your laurels as an engineer by the sounds of it.
Definitely not.
And we're just going to finish up with, what's a piece of engineering that impresses you?
The piece of engineering that impresses me today, it's the new safety confinement, I think, NSC at Chernobyl. So this is a enormous project that they've spent more than 15 years doing. It was in testing and commissioning in February. It cost over 2 billion euros to create this thing. It's a confinement, so it's a big building that they have had to put over the sarcophagus at Reactor 4 at Chernobyl, which is the one that blew up.
Yes.
And it is fully climate controlled inside, and it is fully fitted out inside with robotics that will deconstruct and decommission the reactor.
Yeah.
And it's going to be there for the next 100 years. So it's incredible.
We actually saw a documentary on it. It was amazing. Yes. I think it was four part. We only caught the last one or something like that.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
And just seeing this massive building moving on rollers, because they had to kind of build it far away because building it on top was not safe, so they had to build it. And then they had to wheel it over the top of the, what did you call it, the sarcophagus?
Sarcophagus.
Yes.
The sarcophagus.
So the initial thing that they did to
to stop the spread. Like they whacked up a cement building or something like that. And so they put this thing over the top and they just had to fit it. And there was an arm that came up and went down. I was like, yeah, it was crazy to see this massive building.
Awesome piece of
engineering. I hadn't realized that. I don't think I had clicked about the robotics on the inside either. So I vaguely remember something about that. But that was amazing. How long did you say that took them?
They started the design in 2004. They started the construction in 2010.
Wow.
And they just finished the construction, I think, at the end of last year or the start of this year.
That is a massive project.
Very long-term project.
It's got is it a 100-year life expectancy?
Yeah.
It's just phenomenal.
To stand for years, yeah. It's incredible. And I was particularly impressed with the robotics inside because having worked in a nuclear facility, I'm to understand that electronics are particularly susceptible to radiation damage. Mm. And so to have built the system as they have, so in order for it to withstand the radiation inside and be able to actually deconstruct the reactor inside, it's quite incredible.
That would have been groundbreaking work. To just make those the building itself, but to make the robots that go on the inside as well. So, yeah. Well, thank you for
definitely nothing out of the box for that one. That's for sure.
No,
nothing off the shelf.
Yeah, that's right. And just to finish up, do you have an engineer that you admire?
I do, Hedy Lamarr. So she was not formally trained as an engineer or a physicist or anything, but she was an actress in the 1940s and also an inventor.
Ah.
So Hedy Lamarr heard about the problem with torpedoes and the radio frequency jamming that could impact them and stop them from getting to where they needed to go. And so she designed the frequency hopping technology in order to make them hardened against these frequency jamming attacks. And that is the technology that's used in Bluetooth today. She came up with this idea of and this technology for frequency hopping that we use today all the time for Bluetooth.
Yeah, right.
That's amazing. So she's the mother of Bluetooth.
Yes.
Oh, wow. I'm going to be looking her up for sure. Really? That's a good one. Thank you so much
for
coming on tonight.
Oh, it was great. Thanks for having me.
It's been such a blast. And we've picked up so many interesting facts today. It's been fascinating.
Yeah, it's been great talking to you guys.
And thank you for tuning in to episode 11 of Engineering Heroes. If you want to know more about our podcast, your best port of call will always be our website. That's www.engineeringheroes.com.au. Take some time to check out what we have going on. We've got show notes, we've got support pages, we've got contact pages, all that good stuff. If you enjoyed today's show, the best way, the absolute best way to show your support is to go and tell someone. Seriously, it's that easy. Just go and tell somebody and let them know about our podcast. And who knows, they might hook in and listen up as well and learn something new. We look forward to you and your friends joining us next week when we bring you another interview with one of our engineering champions.